the government and IO, or opposition forces, have met. Many of these have been facilitated by UNMISS. The enthusiasm for peace amongst people is palpable. Third, overall levels of political violence have diminished significantly. In blunt terms, many people are alive today who might not have been so without the agreement having been signed. The exception is in central Equatoria, where fighting close to Yei between the forces of Thomas Cirilo and the South Sudan People's Defence Force have been clashing. Once again, civilians in this area have borne the brunt with reports of killings, lootings and sexual assault. Cirilo shows no sign of wanting to join the existing peace process. Fourth, for the first time in 3 years, people are expressing a willingness to return home. An estimated 135,000 refugees have returned, in addition to many internally displaced who have signalled they also want to go home. So far, actual numbers are relatively small when put against the approximately 2.3 million people who live as refugees and 1.9 million displaced inside of South Sudan, a figure that comprises nearly one-third of the population. But it reflects a trend. People seeking to travel in the dry season, which is with us now, to be home in time to plant crops in July. That's the positive side. The significant challenge is to maintain the momentum of the peace process. The timetable set out in the agreement is well behind where it should be, and many of the bodies set up under it are still dealing with procedural rather than substantive issues. There are fundamental issues still to be resolved, many of which were deferred to enable the peace agreement to be signed. These include the resolution of the boundaries and states and the formation of a unified armed force to be deployed in Juba and all of the major towns. The constitution-making process is also facing challenges in the period. The current phase of the peace process, the pre-transitional government period, ends on 12 May. From this point, a revitalised transitional government is scheduled to take over, and the vice presidents, including the first vice president, Riek Machar, should have taken up their roles. What does this mean? A peace process that falters generates frustration, it generates anger, and a possible return to violence that could equal what occurred in 2013 and 2016, and we cannot allow that to happen. There are some who believe that a return to violence is inevitable. We don't concur. This agreement has broader buy-in from parties than the 2015 agreement. It is widely embraced by the population. We too have concerns about the peace process, but there is yet to be a perfect process. For our part, the UN has and will continue to focus attention and resources on making it work. And I want to stress, there is no plan B. There is only plan A, this agreement and this path forward. And for it to have a chance to work, it needs to be supported. A year ago, most of us, including myself, did not believe we'd be at this point today. It has confounded the critics, but we have arrived at this point through the leadership and drive largely from IGAD. And a fully engaged IGAD, supported by the efforts of the African Union, is absolutely critical. But the months ahead will be challenging, as those have been before it. And I would welcome the urgent appointment by IGAD of the new JMEC chair, and to help stir the process forward and overcome some of those challenges. The UN has been working in partnership with IGAD and the people of South Sudan throughout, and through my good offices, we have and will continue to inject specific expertise, ideas and opportunities into the process to maintain confidence and trust and substantively move the peace implementation forward. It is an area where we would welcome a more explicit reference in our mandate to our ability to play that role. We must also acknowledge, though, that suffering goes on. 5 months of a more stable environment cannot overnight redress the levels of food insecurity, nor the absence of health or education services. Humanitarian assistance is still needed to bridge the gap to self-reliance and to support those people who want to move home. But we should remember that tens of thousands of South Sudanese citizens, young and old, are alive today because of the generosity of donor nations and the heroic work of humanitarian agencies. It is a reality that South Sudan's leaders often forget or take for granted, that their country is supported by taxpayers around the world. Last year, donor nations gave life-saving support of more than $1 billion, more than twice South Sudan's state budget. That enabled humanitarian agencies to deliver assistance to 5 million people, or about 83% of those that they had targeted. This year's target is $1.5 billion to reach 5.7 million people. Humanitarian agencies have largely been able to move freely across South Sudan. However, in specific areas, in places such as Yei, particularly where there is conflict and where civilians as a result have been most vulnerable, denials have occurred. Governmental delays, including processing of shipments and the imposition of taxes, has also wasted time and incurred costs in the last 3 months. Excellencies, peace saves lives. It also saves money. South Sudan is a country of abundance where nobody should be hungry. The humanitarian bill, I would argue, is ultimately unsustainable. We have felt strongly the need to switch approaches in the country. And so in the last few months, UN agencies and UNMISS, backed by donors, have begun focusing more on resilience that fosters greater self-reliance within communities in more stable areas where we can work. There is a potential in those areas to move away from purely humanitarian support. Secondly, a trust fund has been established to intervene in areas of ongoing conflict. It aims not only to reconcile differences between warring communities, but also to bolster agreements with economic support and services. To give you an example, in the Wau POC, for example, the Fertit community have wanted to move back to their land that they were forced to abandon. A greater chance of success is likely for them if the differences between them and the Dinka cattle keepers who are in the area have been able to be reconciled, and that the agreement that is reached is anchored with support to housing, health services and benefits to all communities. With the peace deal, some displaced families are choosing to return home and rebuild their lives. The number of people living in POCs, protection of civilian sites, has dropped from about 205,000 to 193,000 in just 3 months. When Wau, for example, it's gone from 13,000 to about 13,000. UNMISS supports the returns process. We have undertaken frequent look-and-see trips where we helicopter people to locations to assess for themselves whether it's safe to go home. And as a result, many have decided to leave. Hundreds have now left the Bor POC, for example, transported by helicopter, but mostly others by barge. Humanitarian agencies are currently programming agricultural education and health support in areas expected to be of high return, and UNMISS peacekeepers are refocusing priorities from more static operations around POCs to patrolling anticipated returns, areas of return to increase confidence. UNMISS is very mindful of its protection mandate, but let me be absolutely clear, we will not push people out of POC sites against their will. However, those who want to leave, we will support them, because not to means condemning them to a life in a camp. And our actions will be continued to be consistent with international principles and humanitarian NGO guidelines to be voluntary and dignified. The next 3 months is critical. After that time, the rainy season makes land transport impossible in South Sudan, and the planting window for crops will be lost and we'll have another year's delay. A key reason why people tell us they are reluctant to return home, of course, is security. Sexual violence continues to cause immense harm to women and girls across the country, most recently in Northern Unity, where the concentration of forces from all sides of the conflict has led to horrific incidents. The violence must end, and the perpetrators must be held to account. Ending impunity is a core function of the government and a vital part of the reconciliation and the peace process. It is UNMISS's mandated role to actively deter and prevent as much of these horrific crimes as possible, as well as monitor and report publicly on violations of human rights, particularly where sexual violence is concerned, as we did 2.5 weeks ago in Benchu. But we're also working with the government, it's worth stating, to build on the capacity of the justice system to deal with these crimes. And this includes operating a mobile court system where prosecutors and judges are being flown to hotspots like Benchu and Malakau to hear the cases. It's led to several dozen perpetrators being jailed and tried and jailed. That one session in Benchu, for example, our legal team reported back to me that 49 women queued up in the sun to give evidence in a pre-trial meeting against offenders that were about to be tried. Their desire for justice to end impunity is inspiring. In another case, four young men accused of gang raping a 15-year-old swaggered into the court where they encountered their victims and their witnesses. Their faces fell as they realised that the survivor of their brutality had the courage to testify them and had the faith that justice would prevail. They were all convicted and they were all sentenced to between 3 and 12 years. These are small steps, but they're important ones. This month, a UN-supported special court for gender-based violence will be open in Juba with the jurisdiction to hear those sorts of crimes. Madam Chair, in conclusion, there is just 2 months left of the pre-transitional period and progress has been slow and there's much still to be done. All of us, the parties and the stakeholders, but most of all the regional partners, must drive the implementation forward and ensure it is adequately resourced. And the government needs to play its part to contribute financially as well. This peace process agreement is far from perfect, but it is the one that we have in front of us today and we're not going to get another chance at it. The cost of failure is unthinkable. So while responsibility lies primarily with the parties to the conflict, it is also beholden on us all to ensure that we make the necessary moves forward together to make the agreement a reality for the sake of the people of South Sudan. I thank you, Madam Chair.